Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In chapter 8 of Notes from Underground, Fyodor Dostoevsky has this extended passage where he's discussing the relationship between reason and desire. And will and wish are also brought in there, as are the sort of utopian or humanitarian, or whatever we want to call them, plans of reformers, people who want to change society, people who want to gradually change or improve or unveil genuine human nature as they take it. And I think this would apply to many moral philosophers as well, not just those engaged in you might say, political and social projects, but also those who are focused on just one's own self-improvement. And the basic idea that all of these people have that he's attacking is that in some way, our desires and desire in general could be made fully rational. That is, the conflict that we often experience between desire, which wants what it wants, and if we're not paying attention, will steer us into whatever it is that it wants us to do. And it's also part of ourselves, so it's us who are, you know, being steered that way. And then our faculty of rationality that tells us, well, this is a good thing for you to do, and this is a bad thing for you to do. And this goes all the way back to Plato, and if you think about his Republic and the three parts of the soul, you know, the desires, epithumia, and another kind of desire, thumos, the desire for recognition, for status, the part of us that gets angry. They're supposed to be subordinate to the rational part, which can hopefully, if it's developed properly, actually tell a person what would be good for them or what would be bad for them. And this runs throughout ancient philosophy. You find this in Aristotle just as much. You find this in the Stoics. You find this in the Epicureans. You find this in tradition after tradition after tradition, all the way down to the present day for Dostoevsky, reformers, including utilitarians and socialists and all sorts of other people, reformers who want to improve society and improve human beings. So the dream is we could actually have reason if it's properly developed and if the appetites or desires, however you want to put them, the affective part of ourselves, if it's properly subordinated or integrated, then we would actually live a much better life. And he says, you know, if you think about this, what would this be like? So he says, let's examine the possibilities. What do you say? Our wishes are mostly misguided because of a mistaken evaluation of what's in our interest. If we sometimes desire something that doesn't make sense, it's because in our stupidity we believe that it's the easiest way to attain a supposed advantage. So, you know, an account that's been around for a very long time. Why do people do dumb, bad, shameful things? Well, because they're mistaken. They don't understand what truly is in their interest. If their rational capacities were strengthened, if they actually followed reason, well, then they wouldn't do that. So he says, now what's going to happen? When desire merges with reason, then we will reason instead of desiring. It will be impossible to retain reason and desire something senseless that is harmful. So, you know, if I desire coffee after coffee after coffee, you know, drinking 3-4 pots a day, and my doctor points out to me, listen, you really need to cut back on the caffeine consumption. And I'm like, well, okay, I'll drink decaf coffee, 4 pots a day. And then the doctor's like, well, you know, there's more to it than that. The acids are not good for your stomach. And I go through this entire process and okay, I'll replace it with something else. I'm going to drink tons and tons and tons of tea. And the doctor might eventually get to the point where he's like, do you think that maybe that excessiveness of needing to drink 4 pots of something could be the problem? And, oh yeah, you're right. Eureka, I have a breakthrough. Now I don't desire that anymore, right? That's the way it should work. You have this great realization, and you're like, oh, that's bad for me. I'm not going to do that anymore. I thought it was good for me. I was mistaken. And so Dostoevsky says that's the way that they portray things. He says, once all of our desires and our reasoning can be computed, then we may really have some sort of tables to guide our desires like everything else. And if you want a good example of this, dig around in Jeremy Bentham's works. Don't just read the introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation. Read some of his other stuff. Look at the charts that he makes, and you'll see this sort of in action. And Dostoevsky says, well, that's fine. You can have that sort of project, but here's some considerations that you want to keep in mind. The first one is, he says, reason can be satisfied, and reason can also be very satisfying. In fact, we often find that there's something attractive. This is why Plato could catch on in the first place, or Aristotle, or any of the other philosophers, or even the religious thinkers who say, God gave us a faculty of reason, he wants us to use it to the fullest. There is something attractive about reason. But reason is, in some respect, a seducer. It promises more than it can give. Dostoevsky says, reason satisfies only the human being's rational requirements. It does not satisfy all of our other requirements. And he guesses or specifies just how much reason would actually apply to. He says, oh, maybe 1/20th of our lives, 1/20th of the whole. He says, I instinctively want to live, to exercise all the aspects of life in me, not only reason, which amounts to perhaps 1/20th of the whole. Maybe in some people it's 1/100th. Maybe in some people it's 1/5th. Maybe in some people it's even 1/2. Or let's say it's 99%. If there's something that is left out, the person is not going to be completely satisfied. And the problem is that reason can't recognize and can't acknowledge that it's not being completely satisfying. So he says, reason is only reason. It only satisfies our rational requirements. Desire, on the other hand, is the manifestation of life itself, of all of life. And it encompasses everything from reason down to scratching oneself. So desire is, in some respect, more encompassing, and reason is just a part of it, or reason is just within, desire's purview rather than desire being within reason's. You could think of reason as a way in which, perhaps he's not saying this here, but we could extrapolate this as a way in which desire works upon itself. That would make perfect sense. So desire is of a much wider extent. It includes scratching yourself. It includes what you want to eat. It includes all the things that, don't seem to be quite so amenable to reason, which would probably include also our moral life, our beliefs about what is ultimate, romantic entanglements, enemies, friends, pick whatever it is that you like, all the way down to what sort of candy or beer or coffee you prefer. Much of these things have an immediate relationship with desire that is lacking when we think about reason. So he goes on and he says, what does reason know? It knows only what it has had time to learn. This is another fundamental distinction between reason and desire. Reason is really powerful, but it can't take into account what it doesn't know adequately. It's blind in that respect. It's blind to what it's blind about. Somebody, came up, and I'm sure it's not Rumsfeld originally coming up with this, the distinction between known unknowns and unknown unknowns. Rumsfeld got a lot of heat for this, but it's actually a really brilliant distinction. Reason doesn't know what it doesn't know. There's lots of unknown unknowns. And it's not as if desire knows them, right? Or desire is a new way of knowing or anything like that. Reason does have the advantage when it comes to generating knowledge. But desire relates itself to reality much more directly. He says, human nature is just the opposite. It acts as an entity using everything it has, conscious and unconscious. Even if it deceives us, it lives. I suspect, ladies and gentlemen, you're looking at me with pity, wondering how I can fail to understand that an enlightened, cultured man, such as the man of the future, could not deliberately wish to harm himself. And he goes on and on, and he talks about how it is that the ordinary person, and we'll come back to this in a moment, but think about this, the ordinary person has to have some sort of immediate relationship with the world, because otherwise they have to wait around for a philosopher to explain it to them. We'd never have a human race, right? So through our desires, we do in fact relate ourselves to things far beyond the scope of our knowledge. And through that, we actually sometimes get to know them. This is not something radically new, by the way, that Dostoevsky is saying. Just to give you one example of somebody else who thinks something sort of like that, although he'd reject some of the underground man's premises. Think about Thomas Aquinas, right? The intellect knows reality in certain ways. It knows it under the aspect of the true. But the will knows reality in a certain respect even more directly. Even though it doesn't necessarily cognize it and does so through practicality, right? The realm of practical reasoning in which desires and pursuit are analogous to affirmation, right? And aversion and going away are analogous but not exactly the same as denial. The will grasps the good and grasps reality as such, which even actually opens up a realm for our emotions to, in a certain way, be a thing connect, or not a thing, a mode connecting us to life more directly. Now, of course, Thomas is more of a rationalist than this underground man. He's got a great deal of confidence in reason. But we can see that this is a part of the philosophical tradition. We don't have to go to somebody like Hume saying reason can only be the slave of the passions to recognize that the realm of desire may in fact be much wider than the realm of rationality, according to the underground man. He brings up another really important set of points as well. And we touched on this in talking about desire being more encompassing than reason or rationality. Desire always possesses a certain priority, not only a practical one, but we could say an ontological one, one at the very core of human being, over rationality. He tells us that desire can, if it wishes, agree with reason. That's up to desire. We often think that reason in some way, or we portray reason as in some way, being able to coerce and impose itself upon desire. Unless desire actually decides to go along with it, you know, sort of like indulging one's eccentric uncle and saying, oh yes, I'll go take a walk with you. Let's see where we're going, rationality. If desire doesn't choose to do that, then reason can talk and blather all at once, but it's really just talking to itself. Desire is already thinking about the stuff that it wants and not paying any attention to what reason was. A great emblem of this could be thinking about the typical college classroom, where we know from, you know, psychological experiments that many of the students are not actually paying attention the entire time the way an instructor might believe that they are. And it's up to the instructor to somehow reach the students, and sometimes the students won't be reached. There are some days where nobody's paying any attention whatsoever because their minds are on something else. So if desire does go along with reason, it does so because it chooses to, or desires to, or wishes to, right? What else? Well, what's the normal case for desire and reason? He says, in reality, desire usually stubbornly disagrees with reason. The underground man goes further than most people will, and actually against many of them in saying, and let me tell you, this too is useful and praiseworthy. Typically in philosophy, we look at desire and reason and their conflict as if, you know, if there is a disagreement, we should always be on the side of reason. desire needs to shape up and quit, you know, being so obstinate about these sorts of things. And if it does, then it's good. And if it doesn't, then it's bad. And Dostoevsky is willing to say, well, no, maybe sometimes right is on the side of desire and not rationality. The last thing, and this leads us into other discussions, is that perhaps it can be a desire for us that we get to desire, that we get to follow our desires, even if they are irrational. As he says a little bit earlier, talking about the stone wall and saying that it's sort of the metaphysical equivalent of people saying 2 + 2 = 4, he says, yes, I totally recognize that. The rational part of me grasps that. That doesn't mean that I have to accept it. I accept, of course, that the wall is there. I don't accept that I have some sort of role in creating it, or that I'm responsible for it, or that I even have to follow the rule that's involved in the wall. I can smash my head into it if I wish to. Perhaps it is true that we actually have a desire to be able to desire. And you might call this, following Harry Frankfurt, a second-order desire, if you like. Dostoevsky is talking about this a long time before that, well over 100 years, and this would be a desire to actually get to decide things for ourselves. So, as you can see, desire has a great priority over rationality for the underground man, and arguably for Dostoevsky himself, and this is in opposition to much of the long-standing tradition of philosophy. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.